Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. Today we're going to be talking about Revenge of the Sith, the third and final of the prequel trilogy, wrapping up our Star Wars marathon in preparation for today's release. Today is the day. The Force Awakens has arriveth. I'm podcasting this about a month in advance. It's now November, but I just can only imagine how excited we all are today. And I will have seen The Force Awakens the night before on a Thursday. I wish a good Star Wars experience for all the fans out there. It's going to be a great couple of weeks as we go and watch and rewatch and debate and obsess and dissect Abrams' take on the franchise. And my prediction earlier on was that the film is going to be probably one of the best since Empire. I mean, it doesn't have too much competition, frankly, but so I'm wondering if now that I'm uploading this today, if that in fact was the case. Anyway, let's get back to Revenge of the Sith. So some background on Sith. He had kind of started in working on Episode 3, even before Attack of the Clones was released. And he initially proposed to concept artists that the film is going to open with a montage of seven battles on seven planets. So he wanted to start off with like the Clone War, like in full, you know, the sort of the penultimate battles of the Clone War. But he reviewed the storyline, you know, and radically reorganized the plot. Author Michael Kaminsky in The Secret History of Star Wars surmises that Lucas found flaws with Anakin's fall to the dark side and made massive story changes. So, for instance, instead of opening the film with various Clone War battles, Lucas decided instead to focus on Anakin, ending the film's first act with the killing of Dooku, an action that signals his beginning to descend to the dark side. Lucas had previously promised fans that he would explain the mystery behind the erasure of the planet Kamino from the Jedi archives, but he abandoned that plot thread in order to devote more time to Anakin's story, leaving the matter unresolved on film. As a compromise, Lucas permitted author James Luceno to explain the mystery of Kamino's erasure and the origins of the clone army in his expanded universe novel, Labyrinth of Evil. Lucas had originally planned to include even more ties to the original trilogy and wrote early drafts of the script in which a 10-year-old Han Solo appears on Kashyyyk, but the role was not cast or shot. He also wrote a scene in which Palpatine reveals to Anakin that he created him from the midichlorians and is thus his, quote, father, a clear parallel to Vader's revelation to Luke in Empire. But Lucas ejected this scene as well. There is scuttlebutt, too, actually, that Darth Plagueis was the only Sith who was able to manipulate the midichlorians directly to create life, and that I think it might even be in one of the expanded universe novels that Plagueis is responsible for Shmi Skywalker's pregnancy. Lucas made a lot more changes to Anakin's character, sharpening his motivations for the dark side turn, and he edited a lot of the principal footage and filmed new scenes. So he was shaping and molding the story as he was, you know, filming it. He didn't really have it the way he wanted it. In the previous versions, Anakin had a lot of reasons for turning to the dark side, one of which was his sincere belief that the Jedi were plotting to take over the Republic. Although this is still intact in the finished film, it's really, you know, he emphasizes his desire to save Padme, which became, you know, a more simplified reason. And I think probably the best way to go here, in that it made it more personal. Let's get to the film. An immediate nit I have is with the title of the film. When you have Return of the Jedi, you have a return because the Jedi have been extinct from the galaxy for years, and other than Ben Kenobi and Luke and Yoda. So in a sense, when Vader kills the Emperor and is in turn killed by the Emperor's power, Luke kind of becomes a Jedi And that, then at that point, he's the only Jedi in the galaxy that we know of. And in a sense, you know, you can take the title as the Jedi have returned, because Yoda told him he would not be a Jedi Knight until he faced Vader. So makes sense. Revenge of the Sith. What happened to the Sith that they need to take revenge? You know, like what are they taking revenge for? Even in Attack of the Clones, we have Darth Maul. Soon we will have our revenge. Revenge for what? What happened to them? Totally not put in the film. And George has done this with a couple of things. You know, the taxation and trade routes in the first film. Why, you know, the Trade Federation is so, got such a hard-on for Naboo. Never discussed, never talked about. And same with this. Like, the Sith are just these bad guys who are trying to get revenge. For what? We know not. I'm all of a fan for things being mysterious in some ways, but I would have loved in another universe for Vader to become, still remain mysterious and not have the backstory of Vader be filmed, right, in some ways. But when you're talking about revenge, I mean, it's a very specific emotion. It's a very specific goal to take revenge and, you know, to not know what the revenge is for. I don't know, kind of weird. Anyway, the opening sequence is astonishing. As far as sci-fi film, I don't think the opening battle has been topped since it came out. It is, the effects are unparalleled. And George is getting more and more adventurous with the camera. I feel like he's loosening up a lot. Or he's got guys on his visual effects team that are pre-vising things in a really cool way that he's approving. You know, we start out with a long tracking shot. George Lucas channeling, you know, Scorsese, as it were. The camera zooms through this whole opening thing without cutting. And during this shot, the clarity and the depth of the effects in all the ships in the shot cannot be understated here. You know, we have this wonderful drumming, so the soundtrack is a bit understated as well. We start out with a Republic capital ship, and then these two Jedi starfighters sort of zoom overhead, and the camera picks up speed to follow them. They zoom in very close to the Republic ship, which gives us an amazing sense of scale. And then, you know, they're incredibly in tandem. They're doing maneuvers exactly with each other. They clear the bow of the Republic ship and then do this incredible dive. And then we get the camera kind of moves out and we see this incredible vista of all these capital ships fighting each other. And then beneath is the city, I think the Night City of Coruscant, with all these radiating spirals of lights from all the massive cities below. It is beautiful. Hundreds of fighters and capital ships going toe-to-toe with each other. Really, really beautiful. You know, what I like here, too, is that what we're getting is the three-dimensional nature of space battle, which we don't always get in a lot of sci-fi films. They tend to two-dimensionalize it so that, you know, it's easy to for the viewer to carry. But George really does the 3D thing here, man. And when we're flying in and around these ships, we don't know which way is up, which I think is really, really cool. We were seeing also the ARC 130 starfighter, which is sort of the antecedent to the X-Wing. And we get this line from one of the clones, set S-foils in attack position. So that's a very cool little drop there. There's one shot of one of those starfighters where there's two. There's a backup pilot and a pilot, and we see they're both clones, so it's both Temuera Morrison. Very cool shot. Anakin seems a bit older and a little more mature here. His voice is pitched much lower than it was in Attack of the Clones. He's got a scar on his face, which Genndy Tartakovsky's Clone Wars film tells us how he got that. It's really cool. Obi-Wan seems kind of the same. We're introduced to vulture droids and buzz droids. There's a great shot when a clone starfighter is destroyed and the camera zooms by and we see the pilot out in space being blown out of his ship, which is really, really cool. I mean, very, very, in a sense, what I'm used to seeing in Battlestar Galactica, the TV show, how they shoot things. They're, again, very similar here, very realistic looking. They're also using missiles now, and George never really did missiles. It was really, you know, turbo lasers and proton torpedoes, but we're getting our two starfighters evading missiles that are being shot by the droids. You know, he's changing the game a bit. Definitely allowing himself to be influenced by what's going on the small screen, which I think is really cool. There's a cool moment when there's R2, you know, has his moment versus the buzz droids, which, you know, these basically, instead of a missile impacting a ship, when a missile gets close enough to a ship, it disintegrates and like dozens of these buzz droids come out and attach to the ship to try to cut it to pieces, which is very cool idea. like a smart drone, as it were. And R4, which is Obi-Wan's droid, is actually killed and destroyed, so R4 is gone. R2 has a nice battle with one of the buzz droids where he, you know, zaps it with one of his you know, little tools that he has, which is very kind of cool. When Obi-Wan's ship gets hit, the canopy fogs up for a while, and he can't really see where he's going. And it's a wonderfully realistic detail that I really like. So then they enter the ship. Ship is called the Invisible Hand. There's this wonderful, massive flight deck that they enter, and they do some saber battling with some droids on the flight deck. But again, you can see out past the door that the battle's still going on, which in all of the shots when they're in, you know, in ships, when you're looking out the window, it's just the most incredible stuff is going on right behind them. It's amazing. We get a brief cut where we get our first appearance of General Grievous. He has this strange cough and kind of a strange cadence of his voice. Count Dooku, you're never going to... It's a very weird, kind of childish. And it says Grievous to me is sort of an episode one kind of feel to it in a way. Then we have our elevator comedy where our two Jedi are trying to get up to the main command level to rescue Palpatine, who's ostensibly been kidnapped by Dooku. We know in the background that this was all staged, obviously. And then we get our duel, our first lightsaber duel. Strange to have a lightsaber duel this early in a Star Wars film, but there, I mean, there are like four duels in this film. It's amazing. I like this duel. Some really epic shots when it's just Anakin and Dooku. They do some stuff on a dolly as they're moving backwards, and there's one shot where they're going up a set of stairs, and George flies a camera over them. Very cool. He keeps the camera back a lot, so we see this kind of the cool geometry of these laser swords against each other, which I really like. There's some weird, obvious pausing in the fight where Anakin listens to Dooku, you know, talk, say things, and you realize, why doesn't he just keep fighting? You know, he's waiting for the dialogue, so it's kind of goofy when they're in their lockups, as I like to call them. And the end of the duel is really cool when Anakin does this very complicated maneuver to cut off both of Dooku's hands and his saber. And then there's a great beheading scene, very, very chilling. A really good music cue, and Christensen is okay here, because this should be a complex scene and not a triumphant one where Jedi don't kill like this. They take prisoner and so on and so forth. And I got to give it to Christensen. It was a nice moment where he's like, I shouldn't do this. I'm a Jedi. And McDermott is very evil here. Unscissors the saber and, you know, Dooku's head pops off. So all in all, really, really cool duel with the beginnings of Anakin questioning his loyalties to which side of the Force, which I like. So now the Invisible Hand is toe-to-toe with a Republic cruiser. And we're seeing this up close. Like, it's like they're like two, you know, naval vessels broadsiding each other. And it's just incredible to watch. I mean, just, really, really beautiful. The level of detail and the level of presence of the CGI is really incredible. So then, you know, they're captured trying to get Palpatine off the ship. They're taken before Grievous. And a brief moment, and we have a little battle between the Jedi and these Magna Guards, which are sort of the guards that Grievous has around him. And we see that these staffs that they bear can block a lightsaber, which is kind of new for us, you know. Lightsaber, universally, the only thing that can stop a lightsaber is another lightsaber. But these Magna Guards have these staffs that that can do it. So kind of interesting. There's a pretty interesting escape here when Grievous is surrounded by Anakin and Obi-Wan. He throws one of those staffs at a window and smashes it out. And then he flies out, but being a half droid, doesn't need oxygen. So he kind of gets to another part of the ship and escapes. And then we have the landing of the Invisible Hand by Anakin. They have to land the, again, you know, these capital ships landing on the planet, always problematic for me. But it's very Flash Gordon, this landing sequence, and it is what it is. There's one scene where the visual effects people took from the Columbia disaster, the one that burnt up in re-entry. There was a very famous couple of shots about that disaster where you saw the kind of glowing embers of the ship up in the upper atmosphere, and they basically stole that and used these effects as this ship is starting to land, which I didn't love. I don't love when, you know, when I see stuff that's obviously patterned on 9/11 or stuff like that. I'm sort of like, it's a little too, you know, exploitative, but I don't know. That's just me. There are fire ships flying alongside the Invisible Hand, though, putting out the fires as it's landing, which I think are really cool. So then we get this landing at this beautiful Coruscant spaceport. I mean, it's just gorgeous looking how large this thing is. Then R2 and 3PO are reunited because R2 was on Anakin's ship and has now returned with him. And then there's the reuniting of Padme and Anakin as they kind of, you know, mac out in the corner there in this little darkened part of the hangar. And her hair is very close to Leia now. She's got kind of earmuff-like hairdo, which I think is very clever. They're very hot and heavy now, and we get the plot point that she is pregnant. And they're a little bit better in this scene. You know, the dialogue is still pretty terrible, but they're a little more subdued and less goofy. So, you know, it's like a lessening of the evils of the writing and acting and whenever those two are together. We get a brief cut to General Grievous landing on our next Star Wars planet, the Utapau planet, reporting to Darth Sidious and being instructed to move the leaders of the Separatists to a planet called Mustafar, which we have not yet seen. Now we're at the apartment of Padme, and there's a beautiful night shot of Coruscant. So much beautiful photography in this film. It's so realistic looking. It just looks so good. But now we're back to bad Anakin Padme nonsense. Quote, "You're so beautiful." "No, it's because I'm so in love." "No, it's because I'm so in love with you. So love has blinded you. It's not what I meant." Like, it's abysmally bad, as usual. But we get the first of his dreams of he wakes up in the middle of the night. And actually, this time he tells her, "You die in childbirth." And in the next sequence, he goes right to Yoda with the dreams. And Yoda kind of says, you know, he's like, what do I do? What do I do? And Yoda's like, "You must let go of all you fear to lose." I have an aside about this. I remember reading a reviewer, I don't remember what, here in New York, one of the New York papers, I think it might have been in the Village Voice or something, where they were very critical of this line, and they were saying, you know, this poor guy is worried about his wife dying, and here Yoda is mouthing off these platitudes, "You must just let go of everything." You know, what bullshit. But I think he misunderstood the scene, and I think throughout this film especially, what I really like is underneath is that exactly that fact that if Anakin would have let go of the fear of Padme dying, she would have never died. She would not have died in childbirth. And it's a brilliant catch-22 of you know, what it's like to be consumed with fear and doubt and act on it and to surrender all of it. You know, like, if he's not afraid of Padme dying, he's not holding on to Palpatine when Palpatine is the Sith Lord. And without that, the Emperor probably would die. I don't think the Emperor can withstand Mace and him at the same time. But he needs the Emperor because he wants that knowledge of how to bring people back from death, because he is convinced that if he does not take massive action, that Padme is going to die. The fact remains, if he, the minute he surrenders this and gives it up to the Force, he just stays with Padme, does the best he can, she would never die in childbirth, you know, like, they'd have a happy life together in some degree. You know, it's his clutching on to that, not letting go and believe and allowing, because in a sense, the nightmares are not a true, they're a true premonition only if he continues to fear and continues to clutch and be affrighted by the nightmares. The minute he lets go, he kind of faces his fear, faces his nightmares and says, "I'm not going to act different from my principles just because I'm afraid. You know, if my wife dies, my wife dies, and I'm not going to destroy the galaxy to keep her alive. You know, if it's this, I'm not going to become an evil person to keep her alive." She would never die, you know, and he would have brought balance to the Force way earlier than, you know, 20 years of mayhem, and then he brings balance to the Force. So anyway, the letting go of all you fear to lose is exactly that. Like, in a sense, in his heart, he has to let go that if death comes for her, he's powerless over it. So it's a great little catch-22 in the film that I like. Now we're going to get a lot of wonderful, which I'm very rarely, I've never seen in a Star Wars film, a lot of good political machinations and a lot of people in rooms talking, which I like, actually, for a change. So we get this Obi-Wan-Anakin exchange that starts it, where Obi-Wan is reluctantly relaying the message of the council that he wants Anakin to spy on Palpatine, because Palpatine has kind of forced their hand by saying, "I'm going to name you to the Jedi Council as my representative," but he's not a master yet. So there's all kinds of crap going on. You can see on one side that the Jedi are really kind of not doing a great thing here. They don't trust Palpatine, and so they're asking Anakin to do something that's kind of against the Jedi code. So their hands are not clean. for this point, because the Jedi, they're kind of giving in to fear of not being able to see because of the dark side. So now they're resorting to these other methods that they don't usually resort to, you know. So it's for real that the Jedi Order is kind of not at its best right now. And so he's not granted the rank of master, even though he's on the council, and he's very angry about it and wants it. And he's basically told to sit down and shut up when he says anything about it. So it's a really good conundrum here for both sides. I really like it. And then later on, as they're driving, you know, Obi-Wan to the spaceport, he's going to go find Grievous, and Yoda's going to go to Kashyyyk. They start talking about the Force and about Palpatine and about Anakin, and it's very, very, like, very ominous. A lot of mystery here about they don't know what's going on. I really like it. And then we get a brief conversation between Padme and Anakin where she's really wavering in her support to the Republic, and she's like, you know, they won't stop the war. You know, are we on the right side? And Anakin's like, you're beginning to sound like a separatist. And so we see the conflict between the two of them. And then now she's pushing him as well, like, use your friendship with Palpatine and get the war stopped and let us resume diplomatic solutions. So again, he's getting now his wife in a weird way is trying to manipulate him and say, why don't you use your friendship with Palpatine? Although she, you know, at the end of the day, she's like, you do what you need to. But so he's getting it on all sides. You know, he's getting pushed around by a lot of people, and he's not the strongest emotionally centered guy to begin with. So it's Lucas is very, I hate to use the word because he's never this, but he's very subtle. You know, he's subtly, we see, because you really have to, I don't know, I don't think he succeeds at the end of the day. I really don't buy Anakin going over that fast and that deadly, where he's killing younglings and all this, but I see Lucas really trying to put all the irons in place to make us see this turn, so I give him credit. Now we have this beautiful opera scene, and incredible visuals and score as well. Williams scores it with this low, sort of this Australian Aborigine type sound, but it's really, really ominous, man. These very low voices, and the opera itself is beautiful. It's the Mon Calamari are doing the opera, and they're swimming in and out of these gravitationally held spheres of water. Like, I've never seen the like of it. And it's a very quiet scene. The whole opera house is very hushed, and there's that low music playing. Like, it's a wonderful scene. And Ian McDiarmid is masterful here. He is wonderful as he is trying to seduce Anakin, and he tells him the story about Darth Plagueis. And those in the know realize that Plagueis was his master, and that, you know, Sidious actually killed Plagueis. And so kind of a double meaning here when he's like, he was so powerful, but what he didn't see was his apprentice who killed him quite easily. So kind of interesting. So the ask to spy on Palpatine comes out into the open. And McDiarmid is just a master here. He's wonderful acting. He's one of the best actors in the prequels. He's always great. Whatever lines he has to deliver, they're always done really well. He Neesonizes everything. So now we're actually shown Chewbacca's home planet of Kashyyyk, which is really cool, kind of a planet of water and steppes, what I mean, like African steppes. So it's kind of like half African, half like water planet. Really, really beautiful art direction. There's all different kinds of Wookiees and different kind of war paint. And there's a great sequence when the Wookiees go into battle where they all jump up behind this barricade and raise their arms. And it really looks cool. George shoots it really well. We get these cool new droid ships that, again, they're based on, you know, the big droid tanks are always on these large wheels, and this is no exception, except these are over water. The droids are now fighting a combination of Wookiees and clones. We have this two Wookiees, I'm not sure if one is Chewbacca, but they swing out over one of the clone water tanks and throw mines on it and blow it up, and you hear Tarzan yell, which reminds me of Chewie. So it might have been Chewie, the Tarzan yell in Return of the Jedi. So then we get a very kind of poignant scene for Star Wars fans, the parting of Obi-Wan and Anakin. This is the last time they will be together as friends. Obi-Wan's heading out to Utapau to battle Grievous. And it's a warm scene, a very solid, and you know, McGregor is great here, you know, I trust you, you're my friend, you know, you'll do the right thing, and it's really sweet. And then there's kind of a nice scene where it's Anakin and Padme, and Anakin's like, I'm not the Jedi I should be, like, I want more, I just want more power. And he's kind of vulnerable, and then, you know, he immediately locks it down by saying, I'm doing all this stuff for you, and don't worry about anything. But yeah, not bad, as far as these kind of scenes go. Like, it's, again, you're getting at his conflict, which isn't bad. So then we cut to Utapau. The main Utapau guy who meets Obi-Wan is none other than Bruce Spence, the Road Warrior, the autogyro pilot, and also was the train man in the Matrix sequels. Barely recognizable in makeup, but it is him. We have the Obi-Wan Kenobi and General Grievous duel, which isn't bad for what it is. It's some novelty in it. I like that in the beginning we get the Kenobi fighting stance. When he drops down behind Grievous and Grievous turns around, Kenobi turns sideways, he spreads his legs apart, and arches his saber over his head, pointing forward with the other hand, his fingers forked. It's very kind of aggressive for our beloved Jedi, but it's kind of cool to see him getting into things like so spiritedly. There's a funny, what I call a Raiders of the Lost Ark moment when they're surrounded by droids and Grievous sends his four Magna Guards to fight Kenobi, and rather than Kenobi fighting them with a lightsaber, he just kind of pulls down a piece of building on top of them and crushes them all. Reminded me of the scene in Raiders when the guy with the sword is doing all these crazy moves. Indy doesn't have time and he just blows him away with a gun. You know, this kind of reminded me of that in a way. Then we get Grievous in full bore where the four arms come out, each wielding a saber. And I just thought that was really cool and very startling to look at. You know, like the four-arm droid robot, each arm with a saber. Really neat. Of course, he turns into like a twin-engine Beechcraft where the front two sabers are spun like mixing engines or something. Kind of goofy, but we get these melt marks on the floor where the sabers are hitting, which is kind of cool. And then there's a moment when Kenobi thrusts right at Grievous, and so the four sabers come together to block one of Kenobi's. And it's a nice little moment. It's hard to track the fight with the four arms on two, and it doesn't last very long because he lops off two of Grievous's sabers, so you're only getting like two on one now. And then there's a force push, and Grievous realizes he's going to get his ass handed to him, so there's a brief chase with him in one of his escape vehicles and Obi-Wan on a lizard. The duel ends actually with a blaster and not a saber, where Obi-Wan's hanging from a ledge. He force pulls a blaster to his hand, and then he had earlier pulled apart some of the plating in Grievous's chest, so he uses a blaster to get in there and blow him apart. Then we cut back to Coruscant, and the Jedi are talking about having to remove the Chancellor if he's not going to give up his powers, and then the Jedi will have to temporarily take control of the Senate before giving the Senate back power. So they're talking about, like, you know, basically taking over the Republic for a brief time, which, you know, plays into Anakin's fears, I'm sure, as they want to take it over for good, as Sidious will tell him in a little while. So then we have the reveal. Palpatine now reveals to Anakin that he is a Sith Lord. And it's done really well. McDermott is so great. There's a slow, quiet build-up before the conversation, and it slowly moves into him knowing about the dark side, and Anakin draws a saber. Sidious is just in control of everything. And then he goes back and he tells Mace, which Mace is like, you know, you've earned my trust, but wait here because you're conflicted over this guy, whatever. And then we have this wonderful moment of waiting, which, boy, it's so unlike Lucas to have silence and waiting in his movies. But we have these shots of once Mace, Kit Fisto, and Sassai Tin, thank you very much, go to confront the Emperor. We don't see what happens right away. All we continue to cut is shots of Coruscant at night, Amidala on her sort of porch, and then Anakin back at the Jedi Temple, and there's just a waiting. And I feel like George is setting this up as like, this is the moment right before Anakin loses himself, and he takes his time. And there's a beautiful John Williams sound cue here as we're waiting, and it's quiet, and we all know it's coming, but he gives us some space to prepare ourselves, and I think it's really great. So then we have this duel. Palpatine duels with the three Jedi who I mentioned earlier. The initial way it's shot, I think, is really clumsy. We're way too close, and I don't really understand how that Sidious kills two Jedi Masters so quickly in these weird, awkward close-ups. Like, it's weirdly shot. I don't like it. And all of a sudden, we can't really see much, and two Jedi Masters are down, and I just never really bought it. But then we have Mace versus Sidious, and Jackson has some really cool moments where he kind of looks very graceful with the saber, and he did some backhands and some spins. They give him a really intense lockup scene, you know, where the sabers are being held and we just close in on his face. He looks really badass. But a lot of the duel in the chambers are them kind of dueling around furniture, and they're just kind of hitting at each other's sabers over each other's head. It looks very fake. There's a wonderful thing of when Mace has a backswing and smashes out the window in this the Chancellor's chamber. Really cool. And you're reminded that, like, oh, yeah, these things are real, you know? And then Anakin shows up because he can't stay away, because he wants to make sure that Mace doesn't kill him, because he needs him, you know, to help save Padme. We get the saber versus the Force lightning. And I'm always confused here. I never really know whether, if Anakin hadn't showed up, whether Mace could have beat him. Because it looks like Mace is able to direct the Force lightning back at Palpatine, slowly disfiguring him. But I know that Sidious does this on purpose in order to engage Anakin to his cause. So he wants to look pathetic and almost at death's door in order to get Anakin to kill Mace and to finally kind of step over to the dark side, you know? So always, always curious if Mace could have beat the Emperor. I'd love to get George, you know, one thing I think I would ask George would be like, could Mace have won that battle without Anakin? You know, so anyway, Mace is killed and Anakin is done. Now completely surrendering to the dark side. We have the disfigurement of Palpatine, which I don't think the makeup was done very good here. It's a little puffy and fake looking, but the voice now drops down to the voice we're used to hearing in Jedi of the, you know, Palpatine's great, McDermott's great emperor voice. And so Anakin now leads a contingent of clone troopers to the Jedi Temple to take care of business. And then we get the very tragic Order 66 here, which is really done to some very tragic John Williams music. Starts out where Commander Cody blasts Obi-Wan off of his creature, and Obi-Wan hits, falls to in this water, but survives, of course. But then we get this, all these shots of all these different planets, of all the Jedi being betrayed by the clones, and it's an incredible series of landscapes and planets, like just one interesting novel thing after another. And when we finally get to Kashyyyk, Yoda senses it just before it happens, and he beheads two of the clones in a very cool, like, badass move. The Wookiees are there, and they're friends of Yoda, so they're protecting Yoda, and they get him to his little sort of pod to blast back off. And then we get to the brief moment of Anakin about to kill the younglings, and I thought, boy, this is about as dark as Lucas is ever going to get, man. And you get this really cute actor saying, Master Skywalker, we don't know what's going on, what we're going to do, and he's a really cute kid. And then we just see Anakin ignite his saber and we cut away. It's like, man, George, killing kids. it's hardcore for him, you know? What it must have taken for him to leave this scene in. Bail Organa comes a little bit later to the temple and sees one of the younger Jedi, not a kid, but not an adult, get killed by the clones. So he witnesses what happens and then he bails out. And then we get this shot of Bail Organa, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Yoda on the Tantive IV. So they're walking down the corridor that opens up A New Hope. And it's really cool because the prequel trilogies are all about a lot of color, whereas the original trilogy, at least the first film, black and white, you know, lots of black and white because we're on the Death Star so much, you know, and we're getting that again because the inside the Tantive is all white like it was in the original trilogy. So kind of a nice little softball for the fans. So now we get this little sort of roundup of the plots. We cut to Mustafar, where Vader has been sent to kill the rest of the Separatists, and we see him finally kill Newt Gunray. After all these movies, Newt finally gets his end. And then at the Jedi Temple, we have Yoda and Obi-Wan investigating and finding out that the younglings were killed and who did it. And we get a little bit of a line that tries to make the Obi-Wan line of Episode 4 go down easier, you know. And Yoda says, "The boy you trained is gone, consumed by Darth Vader," right? And that's right of Return of the Jedi. From a certain point of view, you know, your father was killed. And the same moment in one of the cutaways, we see that Palpatine is now organizing the Republic into a galactic empire. And there's the line, which was probably written by Tom Stoppard, who does polishes on each of these, of Padme saying, "So this is how liberty dies, to thunderous applause." And, you know, this film was made as we were gearing up to go into Iraq or already in Iraq. So, you know, very rarely does Star Wars touch on, you know, politics going on in the world. But I feel like the prequel trilogies are kind of all about what's been happening in this country and how much we've militarized and, you know, surveillance and all that stuff since 9/11. You know, some of that is being dealt with here. And I was like, not bad, George. Then Padme goes to Mustafar, after talking to Obi-Wan, Obi-Wan basically says he's killed younglings, he's gone to the dark side. She won't give him up, so he hides on her ship. And then we have the two last duels of the trilogy. So the first one I'll talk about is the Anakin-Obi-Wan duel, which is pretty good. It goes on for way too long, but it's a pretty good duel. The initial exchange is really good. You know, Lucas is doing more dolly shots where, you know, the dolly is rolling along track and we're following them as they move. I always love those kind of shots because it just makes it look very epic and you don't cut away a lot. He's flying the camera overhead in a few shots, which look great. You know, he's not doing flurry of cuts and confusing a lot of us. He's keeping the camera in interesting places. And then we've got the massive, I don't know if it's Duel of the Fates, but something similar where, you know, this is it. There's a nice shot when the camera is directly behind Anakin as he's pushing Obi-Wan back. And the lightsabers look like these two kind of fan blades spinning around them. Really cool. There's another great moment where, you know, these two have been fighting forever, you know, together. They know each other so well. There's this perfect storm of fake outs and misses by the both of them where the sabers never intersect. And then they both try a force push in each other. And it's so like they had the exact same approach and it didn't work. And they both pushed back. So it was really good. But it gets overlong. Once you get out onto the lava river, it just goes on forever. And there's not enough drama really between them. It's just they're up and down these things. And then they're on the lava river and then it's all kind of boring, but we finally get to the point where, you know, we've been waiting since 1977. For me, as a young boy reading in Starlog magazine, a bit about this new film that was coming out, about the evil Darth Vader having his body destroyed and disfigured with a duel with Obi-Wan on a volcano planet. I mean, that's been in my head for, you know, 30, 40 years, you know? And so finally to see that actually happen, at the end of it anyway, not the duel leading up to it so much, but to see him with no legs and one arm burst into flames on the side and Obi-Wan telling him that, you know, he was the chosen one, you were supposed to bring balance to the Force, not leave it in darkness, and Obi-Wan can't bring himself, even now, can't bring himself to kill his friend. And he had said that, I think as much at some point to Yoda, like, I don't know if I can do it, you know, and so he doesn't. Yeah, he can't actually kill him, even to put him out of his misery. And that's cut back and forth between the Darth Sidious-Yoda battle as well. Not the greatest lightsaber battle, you know, it's a lot of jumping around by Yoda, it's not super interesting. We get some lockup shots, close-up of the Emperor and of Yoda. The one part that I remember is they're battling as the whole dais rises up into the Senate, and we see from a long shot the two swords in the middle of the Senate, which is really cool. And they start whipping, you know, the Emperor starts whipping Senate pods at Yoda and basically just overpowers him, and Yoda bails. And there's always been the question of, like, was the Emperor more powerful than Yoda here? And I think that he was. I think that, you know, in the novelization, we're getting stuff about how the Jedi haven't changed, but the Sith actually have embraced some new things, and they have changed with the times and become new and powerful, and the Jedi have not. I don't know how I feel about that, though. What does that mean? It's not about keeping up and changing with the times. Like, the idea of being on the good side of the Force and being a Jedi is a timeless moral stance. But for me, I do feel like the nature of being a Sith is about acquiring power. And so the nature of being a Jedi is about being available to power, but not acquiring it. So there's only two Sith. I think number one, because of the nature of the acquisition of power, if you had a lot more, they'd be fighting amongst themselves and the Jedi wouldn't have to do much. But that the Jedi aren't necessarily to a man as powerful one-on-one with the Sith, but as an order and their way of doing things. Like, think about the way Luke is the catalyst that destroys Vader and the Emperor, but he doesn't do it himself physically with the Force. He does it with kind of the ethos of the Jedi, of the selfless sacrifice, so on and so forth, and that destroys the two of them. So in a sense, I think Yoda versus the Emperor, like, no, the Emperor is stronger one-on-one, and Yoda is not the kind of Jedi that is acquiring power for power's sake, where the Emperor is, and he's getting into all these new ways of using the Force. Force lightning is supposedly this incredible violation of the Force that's really, you know, spiritually horrible as well as, you know, terrible to behold. So I think Yoda actually is not strong enough to beat Sidious, and I think he knows it, and he bails. Then the ending of this film is what I like to call the prelude to Episode 4, because you're getting all of the threads started here. that are going to carry into episode 4. You get what I think I call the first rebel base on this asteroid. What you're happening here is you're cutting back between what I like to call the two birth sequences, because it's the birth of Vader and it's the birth of Luke and Leia, Vader's children. And they cut back once in a while where both of them are in pain. He is being birthed and she is giving birth. And I thought that was nice. I thought that was like a nice little visual thing that he did there. Very clever. Her losing the will to live is kind of stupid. But, you know, it goes in line with a lot of the dumb things that, you know, George puts into these movies, that she's lost the will to live. Come on, dude, really? I think it would be so much more powerful if, like, you know, Vader had force-choked her nearly to death and that she's on life support giving birth to the kids, because Vader actually did kill her. Like, the force choke that he did damaged her irreparably. That makes sense, you know? And they lost the will to live. What about the children? Wouldn't she want to live for them? I don't know. Didn't like it. There is a great shot of Vader's mask coming down, like, into the camera, because this is really the making of Darth Vader. You know, again, as a Star Wars fan, it gives you chills. You hear the, you know, the music, John Williams chorale music, and the two eye holes are coming towards the camera, you know, as Anakin is about to disappear forever inside of the Vader mask. Really, really great. Then the helmet is completed as the top of it's put on, and we hear the very first of the breath. Man, just really incredible. Right before Padme dies, she says the thing that will be with Luke. You know, Obi-Wan, there's still good in him. I know it. On the other side, when Vader finds out he's killed Padme, there's a really terrible no that he does. And I figured, like, I feel like this could have been so much better, where he could have asked about whether he killed Padme. And then there even could have been a scene where he force throws stuff around. But not if he didn't say anything. You as the audience member would be doing the work about, man, what is going on inside that mask? And that sets the mystery maybe going, rather than, no, you know, it's just stupid. But George is, unfortunately, with dialogue and character, it's all about verbal with him. He's not good at or interested in doing character build up by lack of things or by mood or by showing things. Everything is done with dialogue. Everything is done in voice. Like, if a character feels terrible, George has the character say, "I feel terrible," rather than showing us, you know. And I feel like he missed a small opportunity here for Vader not to react verbally, and for the Emperor to be smiling behind them would have been cool. But anyway, that's my take. And then they have the scene where they split up the children, and we get the genesis of Obi-Wan disappearing in episode 4, where Qui-Gon Jinn is actually returned from the dead. He was the very first one to discover how to become a Force ghost. He is the one who trains Yoda, and obviously Yoda tells Kenobi about, like, I'm going to teach you how to commune with Qui-Gon, and he's going to teach you, you know, how to do this thing. So, you know, when Yoda and Ben disappear, now George is giving us, you know, the background here. On the Tantive IV, we meet Wedge Antilles as a young man, and we're told that C-3PO's mind is going to be wiped, but not R2. So R2 will remember all this, C-3PO will not. We see a burial sequence on Naboo. Amidala is buried looking pregnant. And there's a nice little zoom in here on the little charm that Anakin as Jake Lloyd made for her when he was really young. So kind of wrapping that up. There's a shot of the Death Star under construction with Moff Tarkin. A little bit of a medium shot because I think what's his name was dead. So they had to do a digital Grand Moff Tarkin. But the last shot is of the Emperor and Vader standing next to each other looking at the Death Star under construction. Then a brief shot to Alderaan, and we see the Organas now with Leia. And then we end at the Lars farm on Tatooine. Obi-Wan hands Luke over to Beru and walks off into the sunset like a kind of like a hero in a Kurosawa Western. They're the wonderful two suns sunset, which reminded me of the moment that Luke has in episode 4. And I thought there was another little metaphor here. The two suns representing Luke and Leia, which are setting right now, but will someday come back and rise to take back the galaxy, as it were, from the Empire. One thing I have to say, how radical is it here that you have a big budget, tentpole summer blockbuster where the bad guys win, right? I mean, you could only do it, I guess, because, you know, you've already done the original trilogy, so you're not ambivalent about the bad guys winning and what's going to happen next. But still, this is a major motion picture from a major studio where the bad guys win in the end. They win everything, and they will go on to rule the galaxy for the next 20 years. I just thought it was very radical, if you really think about it. Brief summary of Sith. Again, I think it's the best of the prequel trilogy. The sheer amount of different worlds and special effect shots here are dizzying, and it is a feast for the genre film lover such as myself to just see all this stuff, the battles and the planets and the four saber duels. Like, it's crazy how much is packed in here. And there's very little Anakin and Padme badness, only a few sequences. There's some really quiet moments in this film at the opera and, you know, right before Anakin kind of goes over to the dark side. And Lucas is using some stuff. There's some great political machinations that happen here, a little All the President's Men going on at the same time. So a lot to like about Sith, really. I think because of the nature of the bad actors and the bad lines and the way that Anakin's character is, everything's said, nothing's really felt or shown in a way that I don't really buy 100% his flip. I think George came really close, and I think it was very smart to make it about Padme and not to make it about a political or philosophical point of view, but about his wife dying. Probably the best way to go, but at the same time, you know, it's too quick, and he becomes so, I mean, from one moment where he's conflicted, and then, you know, an hour later, he's slaughtering younglings at the Jedi Temple. It's too much, too fast, and we never saw hints of this really in him before, whereas I feel like George has to seed in things that Anakin does in the other movies where we see him do some really nasty stuff that maybe no one else notices. And then if I could see him jumping into killing younglings, but it's not earned, you know, so I don't really buy it. So a little bit of trivia, not much. Lucas allowed Spielberg to help design some of the sequences during pre-production because Spielberg had said he wanted the experience of using what Lucas had created called this pre-vis technique pioneered by Industrial Light and Magic, which he wanted to use for War of the Worlds. And also, Lucas felt that his role as writer, director, executive producer, and financier were taking up too much of his time, and he needed Spielberg to kind of bounce stuff off of. So Spielberg's main contribution was in the classic lightsaber duel between Obi-Wan and Anakin, which I find kind of interesting. Every clone trooper in the film is a CGI. Not a single clone costume or helmet was created, with the exception, obviously, of Cody, when Cody is unmasked, and he is Temuera Morrison. There are over 2,200 visual effect shots in the film, more than Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones combined. Okay, try that on for size. Star Wars Episode 4 only had 350 shots as a comparison. The sound of General Grievous's coughing is actually George. As they were working on the character of Grievous, he developed a bad cough and he had it recorded and used it as Grievous's own cough. So that ends my coverage of Sith. I'm going to do a prequel talk probably next week or maybe even earlier because I want to talk about the prequels themselves and address all of the hate that is sent their way by a lot of the Star Wars fans and by people in general. So I'm going to do a little summary of the three, which I'll release pretty quickly, maybe in a couple of days. So anyway, that's all I've got to say for this week.
Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com. Or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.